On this week's 51%, we meet with the head of the National Archives amid her tour of presidential libraries across the U.S. Dr. Colleen Shogan discusses the role historical records can play in healing the country's cultural and political divides.
This is our shared history, and there are different interpretations of it.
We also stop by a talk with Supreme Court Justice Sonia Sotomayor and learn about an AI project telling the story of engineer Emily Warren Roebling. I'm Jesse King. It's all up next on 51%.
I was standing around like one of those girls I had seen in a movie. The whole world was a movie back then. I had my sunglasses on, I wanted to be seen without seeing Shiloh Lita. I wasn't really in it, I didn't really get it.
You're listening to 51%, a WAMC production dedicated to women's issues and experiences. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Jesse King. Today, we bring you a pair of interviews geared toward American history, why it matters, and some of the new tools being used to share it. The Franklin D. Roosevelt Presidential Library, a museum in Hyde Park, New York, contains all of FDR's presidential papers, as well as some personal items and collections owned by the president and his wife, Eleanor. The head of the National Archives and Records Administration recently stopped the site as part of a tour she's conducting of presidential libraries across the U.S. Dr. Colleen Shogan was sworn in as the country's 11th archivist last year and has been making the rounds at each of the agency's 43 locations to help them plan for the future. She tells me her trip to the FDR Library served as part research mission, part public service announcement, as she hopes to drive engagement at the agency's archives. Shogan's training is actually in political science, and she hopes these sites and records can help promote a sense of unity and remind Americans of their shared history ahead of November's election.
I've been the archivist of the United States for a year, and when I came on board in May of 2023, I realized, and the National Archives actually has 43 locations all across the United States. We have archival facilities, we have presidential libraries, federal record centers, and of course, some of our buildings in Washington, D.C. And I realized I had to go out and actually see these facilities, talk with staff, figure out what is working at the facilities and what needs some attention and improvement. And once I learned about some of these challenges, then I would be able to know how better to lead the agency. So I'm really on the tour of presidential libraries and all of our facilities so I can understand the agency better so we can serve Americans the most efficient and effective way possible.
And so what has been the visit like at the FDR Library today? Is there anything that has stood out to you?
This is an absolute treasure here, and I'm so glad that I was able to spend the entire day here at the FDR Library. This is the original presidential library in our system because the presidential library system was created by Franklin Roosevelt. And then after he created this library, he let Herbert Hoover create a library. So that's why we also have the Hoover Library that was before FDR. But this is actually the original library. And so to be able to see the origins of the system, really those records about the origins of the presidential library system are here. And I was able to see some of the drawings of the original FDR library and some of the early planning efforts. And when you understand that when FDR was planning this library, he was really giving birth to that entire system, it's very important to spend time here to understand those origins.
I was going to say, what are some practices that started here that we ended up seeing in future presidential libraries?
Right. So the idea that what FDR thought was important was that all of his papers and records, particularly he actually has his papers and records from all different phases of his career here at the presidential library. But what he thought was the papers documenting at least the presidency are needed to be in a place where scholars and researchers and Americans could come and interact with those records, either with exhibits or by coming to a research room and learning about different facets of the presidency. So you see those elements replicated in all of our presidential libraries. They all have research rooms, they all have exhibits, they all have a place in which all of the papers, the memorandum, the objects from that presidency, like presidential gifts, are stored. So you see those elements everywhere.
Is there anything that I guess like surprised you visiting today, or something that you didn't know before that you learned?
FDR had a very, very passionate interest in collecting rare books. That is kind of unusual for a presidential library. You don't see at other presidential libraries, you know, the president's collection of books. But this was very important to FDR, and he viewed this as maybe it would be not only a place to look at his papers, but also to come and do research with his books. And so that's why he made his books part of the library. And it was fascinating to see. He had a Bible that was gifted to him that dates back to the 1400s, which makes it probably the oldest, certainly the oldest book in the National Archives collection, and very, very valuable. So, and then there's other books from different eras in American history that he clearly read and used and considered throughout his career.
But I'd like to talk a little bit about, I guess, like the importance of these kinds of these archives and of these kinds of libraries and stuff, because I know the lesson that I was taught repeatedly growing up is that it's important for us to know our history so that we don't repeat it. But how do these kinds of things shape our knowledge of who we are as a country?
Right. Well, I think it's incredibly important. I mean, the records are important. Federal records are important because they provide transparency. They provide accountability in a democracy. And if you don't have accountability in a democracy, then you really can't have participation in government. And so accountability is necessary for a vibrant democracy. And what we see here at presidential libraries is a documentation of the decisions that were made in various presidencies and various administrations and moments in time. So Americans need to have the ability to look and review those decisions and understand them, and then also have the ability to interpret them in different ways. At the National Archives, we're very cognizant and aware that people look at history in with different lenses and with different opinions. Our job is to make those documents and records and photographs and films available to Americans, whether coming to a museum or coming to our research room, and then let Americans decide about what they think about those actions and form their opinions and their own really interpretation of history.
I was going to ask, you know, with, I guess, sort of like how politically divided we are as a country right now, you know, how can, you know, looking back on this history, I guess, help create a sense of unity almost? Can it? Because everybody has different views of, or different interpretations of, right. of history.
Well, this is our shared history, and there are different interpretations of it, but we can start with the basis that number one that unifies us are our principles that are found in our founding documents, like the Declaration of Independence, our principles in some of our most important speeches, including, for example, Franklin Roosevelt's first inaugural. We can agree upon those principles. How we interpret those principles and put them into execution and practice, well, that's where we have a debate. But debates are very healthy in a democracy. So I think this can be a place where we can come together and have those types of productive conversations, which really is the whole point of why we have democratic engagement and why we have that as our method of government. But one thing I will say about our divisions today, which I was really struck by, was when you enter the FDR Library and you enter the exhibits, the first exhibit that you see that's on display is a number of letters that were written to FDR when he was president from Americans. And all the way from the beginning of his presidency, all the way through World War II and leading into 1945 when FDR's term ends upon his death. And if you take some time to read some of those letters, you will see that, yes, some people were very big supporters of FDR, but there were a lot of people who were very critical of what FDR was doing, either with the New Deal or his prosecution of the war and some of his decisions along the way. And the language in those letters is pretty, is pretty sharp. I mean, we think that we are in a time of terrible partisan division and rancor. But, you know, a lot of that has existed along the way. Americans have always felt the need to express themselves to their elected political leaders. And by looking at those letters, we can put that in context. We can understand this type of debate and dialogue has existed from the 1930s and 1940s forward. It's not just the circumstances that we find ourselves in today in 2024. And that gives us a little bit more perspective.
I guess to talk a little bit about where we are today, in terms of like, how has the job at the National Archives changed with technology? I mean, and the method of how we do it.
absolutely. It is changing the types of records that we're preserving, because those types of records didn't exist previously. So we will be at a period of time 15 or 20 years from now when we will probably be a predominantly digital archive rather than a predominantly paper or analog archive. And that will be because we will have so many emails and text messages, digital photographs, digital videos that will be in our possession. There will be more of those than actually the paper records that we've collected since the beginning of the Republic. And so that changes the whole game for the National Archives, because instead of focusing on preservation and storage of physical collections, we have to focus on preservation, storage of digital collections, and then also figuring out how we are going to share all of those digital records. Yes, of course, we're going to share them online. Of course, that's the way in which we're going to do it. But how is that interface going to be constructed? Do we have the right number of digital archivists working for the National Archives who are specialists in born digital records? Those are some of the challenges that we have right now, so that we can ensure a few decades down the road that we're still able to meet our mission, which is, of course, protecting and sharing our nation's records.
On your visit to some of these sites, have you been able to get a look at, you know, like a sort of how they might be changing as well?
Yes, absolutely. For example, here at the FDR Library, they're talking about in the future when they're able to execute a new type of permanent exhibit, talking about FDR's life and Eleanor Roosevelt's life, being able to have more digital interactives in that exhibit that will be more common to what you see in museums today, so that you'll be able to look at actual records but also be able to interact with things in a digital display. And then also talking about, you know, as much as possible digitizing the records of FDR's presidency and his administration. Of course, there was no born digital in FDR's era, so all of that is paper and analog, so all of it needs to be digitized. And embarking upon a really, really aggressive hopefully campaign to be able to do that in the next decade, so that eventually all of the records of the Roosevelt years would be online and accessible to scholars, Americans, high school students that want to learn more about it, that will be available. And as much as it's terrific to come here to Hyde Park, and this is a beautiful part of the country, the more we put on online, the more that we have that's digital, it means that everyone all across the United States, there are no barriers to access, that everyone can make use of those records.
Well, I guess lastly, you know, are there any other projects at the National Archives that you would like to highlight for us?
Yes, we're very excited about the 250th anniversary of the United States, which is coming up in 2026, which is, of course, the 250th celebration of the Declaration of Independence, which we proudly display in Washington, D.C. So we're doing a lot of planning and to enable to be ready for that. And we are also working very hard to make sure that we are sharing our records to educators, to teachers, and to students, so that we can help teach American history and be in every classroom, every American history classroom, and also in every civics classroom, because we know it's very important for young people to understand how our government operates, what are our basic principles of government, three branches, separation of powers, shared powers, federalism. These elements are very important to teach, and since we are the home of the Declaration, the Constitution, and the Bill of Rights, and other founding documents, we feel it's our job also to help provide the educational materials for those documents. So we're working very hard on that as we lead into 2026. You know, what I'm trying to do as Archivist of the United States is to try to go around. Another reason why I like to go around and visit all of these different locations and facilities across the United States is that I'm able to then talk to people in towns and communities and users and make them aware of all the resources that the National Archives has and encourage them, even if they're a visitor here at the FDR Library, they're here to see the exhibits, they're here maybe to visit FDR's home, to visit Valk Hill, that then when they go home, they don't stop the fascination, that they come online, that they look at what we have online at archives.gov, and they're able to continue the learning and the engagement with all of those records and continue the relationships. So we really want to turn tourists and casual visitors into users at the National Archives.
Dr. Colleen Shogan is the 11th Archivist of the United States and head of the National Archives and Records Administration. She is currently on a tour of presidential libraries across the country, like the FDR Library and Museum in Hyde Park. You can access the agency's records at archives.gov. Next month, the Supreme Court is expected to issue decisions on a number of highly anticipated cases, including a case that could impact the availability of mifepristone, one of two pills commonly used in medication abortions. Ahead of those rulings, Justice Sonia Sotomayor recently made a virtual visit to New York's Capital Region to share advice with local students and professionals at the New York State Bar Association in Albany. WAMC's Samantha Simmons brings us more.
Sotomayor virtually joined a civics discussion to answer questions about her time on the bench. Nominated by President Obama in 2009, Sotomayor commented on the balance of the current conservative-leaning body. She said changes within the federal court system take time, often making it feel like a static institution.
Traditions and commitment to the institution helps remind each justice that the court is not about them. The court is about the court, about its history and its traditions. It's something greater than its individuals.
Ella O'Brien, a senior at Bethlehem High School, will be attending Salve Regina University in Rhode Island in the fall. She asked the justice about her experience as a woman in the courts. O'Brien says she hopes to follow in Sotomayor's footsteps.
It really makes me so excited. More than anything, it makes me so excited to kind of take off on that journey more than anything. I am happy to say that it does not scare me away. And even I know every job comes with negatives and every field you can go into will come with hard things that you have to face, but more than anything, it's excitement.
The justice also fielded questions about how the profession has changed during her tenure and what roles young people can play in civic discourse. O'Brien says the event made her realize the importance of making your voice heard.
I've seen people make a difference, and that's how it's happened in the past before, and it's going to happen again. History repeats itself, and I would love to be a part of it.
Sotomayor says she has been the only woman in the room for most of her career. Her advice for O'Brien was,
you have to handle it situationally. You have to figure out when you need to take a stand and say something. And then you have to figure out what to say and how to say it. And use your judgment in trying to assume the best in people when you can, but to communicate it in ways that may feel less hurtful and more educational.
Sotomayor also warned of the impact artificial intelligence could have on the field of law and how people engage with each other online and in person. Sotomayor says she is shocked by how swiftly technologies have changed.
It's going to take over jobs in so many professions. It may not take over lawyering completely, but it is going to change a lot of the ways of how we lawyer. And that's going to be an area, and I don't care if it's in design or in lawyering, AI is going to change things dramatically.
According to the Bar Association, Sotomayor is a board member of iCivics, a nonprofit education organization. Her talk came as part of a civics convocation focused on a growing lack of understanding about government and how it works among young Americans. Before disconnecting, Sotomayor's last piece of advice for the students was to worry less about the future.
In the end, make a decision that you are going to commit to that decision and make the best of wherever you go and whatever you choose to do. No place is ever going, no school, individual school is ever going to make or break you. You make or break yourselves. So consider your choices, commit, and then make the most of what you're doing.
Samantha Simmons, WAMC News, Albany.
Colleges across the country have been pulling out all the stops for their commencement ceremonies this month. At Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute in Troy, New York, one of their commencement speakers was quite literally a blast from the past.
As I stand before you on this momentous occasion, I am overcome with a mixture of pride and humility.
That's 19th century engineer Emily Warren Roebling. Or rather, that's actress Liz Wiseon, who portrays Roebling on the HBO Max show The Gilded Age. Roebling is thought by many to be the woman who saved the Brooklyn Bridge in the late 1800s, taking over its construction and leading it to completion when her husband, also an engineer and a graduate of RPI, fell ill. This year, RPI awarded Roebling its first ever posthumous degree, and in order for her to quote-unquote accept it in a way that felt real, a team of researchers trained artificial intelligence in Roebling's writing to produce a commencement speech read by Wiseon. Professor Antoinette Meniotti tells our associate producer Jody Cowan that it all ties into the theme for this year's commencement of bridging the past to the future. Roebling worked at a time when women couldn't study at RPI, but Meniotti recently became the first woman to lead its Department of Mechanical, Aerospace, and Nuclear Engineering.
As the first woman in the position, I think it, actually even stepping back, I was the first woman to be a full professor in mechanical engineering at RPI. And now being the first woman head, it just shows that it's definitely, moving forward. We still have a long way to go, though. You know, when I accepted this position, it's a lot of work. There's a lot of administrative work, a lot of headaches. But I took the position because I saw potential to really make a difference. I think the one thing that we do that really excites me is we change lives. We create opportunities for our students. We help them to become problem solvers. And it's a really valuable skill. I see a lot of potential to do more. We don't have a lot of women in our program still. It's still only about 20% of our student body are women. And it's even smaller, certain underrepresented minorities. And I just see that it's a great field to study. And we have a great department to come to and to flourish.
This May marks the bicentennial year of graduation and commencement ceremonies at RPI. And you're part of a very unique project tied to this year's keynote speaker.
Yes. Yeah, so this is RPI's 200th year. And RPI has a long history in the 1800s. We trained the civil engineers that built the infrastructure of this country, the bridges, the canals, and not just this country, but around the world. The Panama Canal, the people who built the railroads in Japan and China were all alum of our program. And one of the very famous people was Washington Roebling, who was the chief engineer for the Brooklyn Bridge. And he and his wife together, Emily, were really instrumental in getting that bridge built and completed. So John Roebling was the father of Washington Roebling, and he had the original vision for the Brooklyn Bridge. He passed away just near the beginning of the project, really before it had even started. And Washington Roebling is an RPI alum. His father had sent him to RPI to learn civil engineering. He served in the Civil War after graduating, and that's where he met Emily, was his commanding officer's younger sister. So there's a whole story there as well. So Washington became the chief engineer, but not long into the project, he developed caisson's disease, or it's similar to what you get when you undergo a very rapid pressure change. So he became somewhat incapacitated, so it became difficult for him to go to the site. And Emily was taking dictation and going down and meeting with the engineers. And over time, she herself had been trained in math and science. And she started, you know, really managing the project and managing it both from a technical point of view, but also from a people point of view. You know, when you think of building bridges, you can think of it both literally and figuratively. And so literally, you know, they were building this bridge, but there were also a lot of bridge building that needed to be done as far as, you know, bringing people on board, convincing people that you still were competent, that it was going to be a success. keeping the project going forward. And Emily was really instrumental in that. And so at the commencement this year, our theme is building bridges to the future. So Emily Roebling is going to get the first posthumous degree, because at the time when she was doing this, RPI was not open to women. The engineering field really wasn't open to women. And we're actually going to have Emily here, in a way, through the actress Liz Wisson, who plays her in The Gilded Age, and through generative AI. We've been, over the last few months, mainly the RPI archivist has been finding much of Emily's writings and information about her from the time period. And we've been feeding this information into a generative AI system that we then have asked it questions and asked it to, you know, what would Emily say if we asked her this? And it'll be an opportunity to hear, you know, from our past and their future.
May you always strive to build bridges, literal and metaphorical, that connect not only lands, but hearts and minds. And in moments of doubt and difficulty, may you find strength in the knowledge that you are part of a grand continuum of thinkers, makers, and dreamers who have left indelible marks upon the world. Congratulations, graduates. May your journeys be fruitful and your lives filled with purpose and joy. Thank you.
And is it true that you're actually related to Emily Roebling yourself?
I am a direct descendant of Washington Roebling's father, John Roebling. And I'm descendant through all women. John Roebling had a daughter, Laura, who was Washington's sister. And that's my great-great-grandmother. So she was the sister-in-law of Emily Roebling. And I think Emily had a strong influence on the women. That I look back at my family and I see that my mother and my grandmother, my great-grandmother were all strong women who did amazing things in their own lifetimes. And I think she influenced the men as well in the family. I think her relationship with Washington was really one of equal partnership. I think that he valued her opinion. It's clear that he spoke to her, bounced ideas off of her, valued her opinion very strongly, which was not common at that time. He took her to job sites, which typically engineers did not do at that time. He always brought her with him. And I think the other men in the family saw that and said, hey, you know, that actually works. So I think that strong women were encouraged in our family and valued.
With this fixture in the Roebling family tree and as a woman in STEM, what do you see as your responsibility to Emily's legacy and your own?
I think it's really important that we make a welcoming and inclusive community at RPI. I think it's important that we value everybody's contributions and that we think more broadly about what excellence looks like. A lot of different ways people can contribute that's important and what that impact can look like. So I think that making a more welcoming and inclusive community where people's ideas are valued and that people have an open mind to new ideas and new perspectives, I think will be good for everybody.
That was RPI Professor Antoinette Maniotti speaking with our associate producer, Jody Cowan. Thanks for joining us for this week's 51%. 51% is a national production of WAMC Northeast Public Radio in Albany, New York. It's produced and hosted by me, Jesse King. Our associate producer is Jody Cowan, and our theme is Lolita by the Albany-based artist Girl Blue. If you like what you heard here, you can listen to 51% anytime at wamcpodcast.org or wherever you get your podcasts. You can stay in the loop on all of WAMC's shows by signing up for our weekly newsletter, Airwaves, at wamc.org. We hope you'll join us next week. Until then, I'm Jesse King for 51%.
I was every single girl, I was nobody else, I was so sure of myself. I was 15 and a half, he was a hollow laugh. And I lost my cool somewhere along the way. The night air down the hallway, I had to learn how to